available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website, the talking newspaper for Coventry. This is Outlook.
Hello and welcome from me, Ashley Haywood, to this week's Outlook, which is being recorded on Wednesday, the 19th of November 2025. Today we're off to the village of Over Whittaker and going on a Coventry Peace Walk. We're also learning a lot more about bowler hats and that fascinating insect, the ant. In addition, we're going to be given some useful and reliable information about bowel cancer, as well as your post bag and an update from the Hub. All that's to come, but first we have the week's local news, read today by Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
A ban on landlords evicting their tenants without reason will come into force in just over 6 months' time, ministers have announced. Landlords will also be prevented from increasing rent more than once a year, while bidding wars between prospective tenants will be outlawed from May the 1st. Housing Secretary Steve Reid insisted the government was calling time on rogue landlords by initiating a raft of measures in the Renters' Rights Act. Ministers have set out a timeline for implementing the Act on Friday, with the aim of giving landlords and letting agents time to see through the changes for their tenants. From next May, the first tranche of law changes will be introduced. These include a ban on so-called no-fault evictions, Section 21, as well as a ban on asking for more than 1 month's rent in advance when the tenancy begins, and a halt to bidding wars between tenants. Landlords will also no longer be able to discriminate against tenants for being on benefits or having children, and will not be able to unreasonably refuse requests from their tenants to own pets. Housing Secretary Mr. Reid said, "We're now on a countdown of just months to that law coming in, so good landlords can get ready and bad landlords should clean up their act." Though the measures are aimed at bolstering legal protections for tenants, the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government was set to insist that landlords will have stronger reasons for getting their properties back when needed as a result of the Act. This includes when they want to sell up, if tenants are in rent arrears or are engaging in antisocial behaviour. Sir Keir Starmer insisted the government believed the majority of landlords were reasonable and respectable. He said, "Of course, the vast majority of landlords are reasonable and respectable, treating their tenants well and providing an important service. But it's about time that we rebalance the system to give renters more rights and more power in their homes, which is exactly what this Act does. This generational uplift in renters' rights is about putting more power into the hands of people who have had to stand for unfair behaviour for too long. By giving renters the rights, security and protections they deserve, we'll be able to prevent homelessness, put an end to unsafe housing and make sure people can live with dignity and without fear for the future." Other measures in the Act will come into force in two further phases. The second phase will include the introduction of a new private landlord ombudsman to resolve complaints from tenants that their landlords do not address, without the need to go to court. A database of private landlords and their properties will also be rolled out as part of the second phase in late 2026. Further measures to ensure private rented homes are of good condition will then follow in a third phase of the Act's rollout. The news was welcomed by rental rights campaigners.
Coventry councillors leading the major regeneration of Coventry City South say it is much needed as parts of the city are tired. Hoarding currently surrounds several buildings, including Hartford House. Demolition is said to be progressing well and should be completed by Christmas. Apartments will then be constructed on Market Way, Hartford Street, Shelton Square and the Bullyard. Additional new facilities will also be developed as part of the £450 million project. Councillor Jim O'Boyle said the area of the city centre being redeveloped was run down and tired. Businesses there were said to have been struggling, even after rents were lowered. He added, Coventry was tired. This area was run down and in need of a complete revamp. We kept lots of rents quite low in order to keep businesses here while we worked through the project. But the truth was, we were losing revenue and footfall. This will completely regenerate the area, bring new homes for the city, which are much needed. We need the opportunity for people to get on the housing ladder, as well as renting and social housing. All of that is going to be here, so it's a whole mix of different types of tenure, and on top of that, the new retail as well. Again, that is very important, he claimed, as 30% of all shopping is done online, so the amount of space you need for shopping in person is now much lower than it used to be. So this is an opportunity to redo our city in accordance with the shopping habits of the city and the country generally. Asked for his personal view on Coventry City South project, Councillor Boyle said, It's going to change the skyline. When I was in my early 20s, Coventry was very different to how it is now. It's always changing and always altering. One thing we are very careful about doing is making sure that there are nice sight lines and that people feel safe. Affordable housing blocks are set to be built on Rover Road near Coventry Market, and construction is expected to begin in 2026.
The WASPI campaign, that is, Women Against State Pension Inequality, has issued an update regarding its fundraising drive for its judicial review claim. The activists are gearing up to present their arguments before the High Court next month, where they will press senior judges to reverse the Department for Work and Pensions' refusal to grant compensation to women born during the 1950s. Nevertheless, the DWP has recently declared that it is withdrawing its decision not to provide payouts, as fresh evidence has come to light. Government ministers stated they will deliver a fresh ruling on the issue. Regardless, the judicial review remains timetabled for December the 9th and 10th. A crowdfunding initiative to meet WASPI's legal expenses has thus far generated more than £252,000, with over 15,000 individuals making donations. Angela Madden, the chair of WASPI, explained how the money is being utilised. She said, Most of it has been used because we've had the lawyers working on it. We've prepared all the case documents. The organisation had previously obtained a cost capping order for the judicial review, which establishes a ceiling on the amount the unsuccessful party must contribute towards the opposing side's legal expenses. WASPI has stated that this was a vital measure to have in place, as without it they may have had to abandon their legal claim, as they potentially couldn't cover the DWP's costs if they lost the case. Ms. Madden said they will be consulting with the DWP's lawyers and the court about how this cap will operate in the event of an out-of-court settlement, now that the DWP has withdrawn its decision. So, what is the WASPI dispute all about? WASPI is one of several campaign groups representing women born in the 1950s who were affected by the increase in their state pension age from 60 to 65 and then 66. They argue that the DWP failed to adequately inform them of the change, with many remaining unaware until the last minute, throwing into disarray their retirement plans.
And now, potentially good news for the visually impaired. A common driving habit could soon be banned across England, marking a significant change for drivers. The government has been reviewing the possibility of implementing a nationwide ban on pavement parking, with ministers indicating their support for such a prohibition. The decision is expected to be announced soon. While completely blocking pavements with parked cars is already discouraged, millions of motorists still park their vehicles on them, particularly on narrow and congested roads where space is limited. Many drivers do this to ensure they don't obstruct traffic or leave their vehicle at risk of being hit. Advocates for the ban, though, argue that this would improve safety for vulnerable pedestrians who often find their path blocked by inconsiderate drivers. However, it remains unclear whether individual councils will be responsible for enforcing the rules locally and how effectively narrow residential streets would be policed. Ministers have been promising a decision for months, but it has yet to materialise. The review itself dates back years to previous Conservative governments, but has been repeatedly delayed. Andy Syrett, UK Managing Director at Your Parking Space, said, "This is a real live issue that affects almost every street in the country. If a nationwide ban is introduced, it would mean a major change to how millions of people park their cars and how they live their daily lives. There's a strong support for safer, more accessible pavements, but it's clear that many drivers are worried about the disruption, especially in built-up areas where space is already tight."
A campaign is calling on the Department for Work and Pensions to scrap the basic state pension and pay everyone the new full rate instead. The petition on the parliamentary website is urging the DWP to make sweeping changes to the state pension system. The petition states, "Increase new state pension and pay to all. Abolish the old basic state pension." It continues, "We think the government should put all our elderly onto the new state pension, increase the new state pension to a good percentage of average earnings, and abolish the old basic state pension. We believe those on the basic state pension should be paid the difference accrued since the new state pension's introduction, with the basic state pension and new state pension. Britain's basic state pension is currently £176.45 per week. Britain's new state pension is £230.25 a week. Britain's average weekly earnings were estimated at £722 in March 2025 by the Office for National Statistics. So far, 358 people have signed the petition, but it needs 10,000 signatures to trigger a government response, while 100,000 signatures could mean it could be debated in Parliament. The petition, started by Michael Thompson, runs until the 13th of December 2025. All petitions will remain open for 6 months.
Britons with normal blood pressure have been given a stark warning, as they may still face danger from the silent killer condition. Fresh research has revealed that individuals in their 30s and 40s who display normal but high blood pressure readings might be quietly damaging their heart. This damage could be occurring long before symptoms appear, raising the likelihood of a heart attack or stroke. The British Heart Foundation has provided an update from the charity with further details. The organisation shared findings from research backed by the BHF and featured in the journal Circulation Cardiovascular Imaging. During this investigation involving more than 450 participants, researchers from University College London found that individuals with elevated blood pressure in their 30s and 40s, which continued for the following three decades, experienced diminished blood flow to their heart muscle by age 77. The study showed that the longer that people experienced elevated blood pressure and the more rapidly it increased, the more significant the decrease in blood flow to their heart became. This compromised blood flow was associated with a heightened risk of experiencing heart attack, stroke, or heart failure in later years. The most significant effect was observed in participants during a crucial period between 43 and 63 years old, when their systolic blood pressure climbed from 120 to 140. Every 10-point elevation in blood pressure during this phase was associated with a 9 to 12% decrease in heart blood flow at age 77. Professor Brian Williams, Chief Scientific and Medical Officer at the BHF, explained, "This interesting research suggests that we should be encouraging people to get regular blood pressure checks from a much younger age, when it's often easier to control. Anyone with concerns about their blood pressure should consult their GP."
Coventry City Council has spoken out following the outcome of a High Court case over an excessive number of asylum seekers in the city. Lawyers for the City Council had claimed that the Home Office had failed to decrease the number of asylum seekers in Coventry and that this was unlawful. But the High Court disagreed, and on Friday Mr Justice Eyre dismissed the claim. Now Coventry City Council has spoken out. In a statement, they said the authority is committed to supporting asylum seekers, but it added that some towns and cities carry a disproportionate burden, which impacts local services. The council is calling for a fairer, more balanced system, and it noted that there has been some progress, namely that there has been a reduction of more than 60% in hotel use locally over the past 18 months. The council said, "Although the review was unsuccessful, our principles remain. We continue to work constructively with the Home Office and welcome progress, particularly the commitment to end hotel use for asylum accommodation. Coventry will keep playing its part in supporting asylum seekers and refugees while pressing for a national system that works for everyone."
The horrific mystery of the armchair killer is among a number of Coventry cold cases that have been highlighted by a new crime map revealing 1,000 unsolved murders. Every case has been the subject of a major police investigation, with some dating back to the pre-war era and others occurring in the last decade. The exclusive list was compiled from Freedom of Information requests to every police force in the country, supported by research through a wide variety of local newspaper archives. Cases include many seemingly random attacks carried out by strangers with no apparent motive. The oldest Coventry cold case included in the files is the brutal murder of Penelope Morgano in January 1954. Penelope, aged 44, was found slumped in an armchair at her home. Her face had been slashed with a carving knife, and she'd been battered with, it's believed, a hammer. In press reports from the time, the murderer was tagged as the armchair killer, and, despite an exhaustive murder hunt, the killer has never been identified. Other Coventry cases highlighted in the map include the mysterious disappearance of 18-year-old mum Nicola Payne in 1991, who vanished as she walked into fog on a wasteland known as Black Pad on the way to see her parents, and schoolboy Mark Billington, who was found dead in Meriden 2 months after he vanished. The online map has been produced to support a special publication, Britain's 1,000 Unsolved Murders, Volume 2, Midnight Stalkers. Might be one to avoid, perhaps. It seeks to re-examine cold cases that have been held in the files of police forces nationwide, in some cases for decades. Many of the cases are so famous that they remain locked in the national psyche, such as the Bible John murders that terrified Scotland during the 1960s. Other mysteries, though shocking at the time, though, have been consigned to history, such as the Cardiff murders of Mabel Harper and Alice Pittman, who were both strangled during the wartime blackout. Each remains an enigma, with families still seeking justice and answers to this day.
Now for something a little bit lighter. Good. Filming is underway for a truly brilliant new Channel 4 show in Coventry. Crews have been spotted on Earl Street. One episode of the upcoming sitcom was filmed at The Yard last Thursday and Friday. It is set to air on Channel 4 in 2026. Manager Kieran Jones said he was thrilled to see The Yard fully transformed for filming. While the plot is still under wraps, he spoke about how enjoyable the process has been for everyone involved. Mr. Jones said, "We are genuinely excited to have welcomed the production team from the upcoming Channel 4 sitcom for filming an episode right here at The Yard. While we are having to remain very tight-lipped on any specific plot details, cast members, or what antics they were getting up to, we can say it has been a truly brilliant and fun experience for everyone involved. Seeing our venue transformed, even temporarily, into a set for a major TV production has been a real honour." He continued, "It is fantastic for Coventry to be chosen as a filming location, and we are proud to play a small part in that. Attracting productions like this to the city brings huge benefits, from boosting the local economy and supporting our incredible creative sector to shining a spotlight on Coventry on a national stage."
The money-saving guru Martin Lewis has issued a warning about a demon appliance that represents the biggest energy drain in the household and ought to be shunned wherever possible. This week, figures emerged showing that families are heading into winter carrying an enormous debt burden of £780 million owed to their energy providers, the highest figure recorded in 8 years. The comparison website Uswitch found that households owing money to their supplier has jumped by 46% from 2.4 million last year to 3.5 million households this year. Mr. Lewis identified the tumble dryer as the device that should be used with extreme caution, given its hefty operating expense of £1 per cycle. He explained, "Do you know what the real demon appliance is in most people's houses? The one that you don't want to use because it's really expensive? Tumble dryers. You're typically paying up to a quid per load, so dry your clothes on an aerator outside to shorten the amount of time you're using a tumble dryer or avoid using it completely. Those who have dehumidifiers can take some of the moisture out of the air. It's less wattage than a tumble dryer, so can be more cost effective." He also said that radiators often heat areas where warmth rapidly dissipates outside. During a previous appearance on a BBC podcast, Mr. Lewis suggested that households should consider installing reflective panels behind radiators, therefore directing warmth back into the rooms instead of letting it permeate through the walls. He elaborated, "A tip for your reflective panels behind radiators. Sheets of reflective material can be placed behind radiators. Crucially, do this on external wall radiators so the heat doesn't escape. If you don't want to pay for them, then tin foil can work, although it doesn't work quite as well. And finally, be a draft detector. What drafts can you spot as you walk around your house? And then try, if you can, to seal them up."
Infant nutrition specialists have urged parents to trust their instincts while highlighting 5 foods that pose risks to young children. Chris Smith, operations manager at Formula Land, cautioned that particular foods must remain completely forbidden throughout a baby's first year. When it comes to potential allergens like peanuts and eggs, current guidance actually recommends introducing them from around 6 months in safe forms like smooth peanut butter and well-cooked eggs, rather than delaying them. Early introduction may help prevent allergies from developing. However, if there's a family history of allergies or eczema, speak with your paediatrician first. Trust your instinct as a parent. If something feels unsafe or you're unsure, wait. There's no rush with weaning, and every baby develops at their own pace. The five foods to keep off your baby's plate. Number one, honey. While honey may appear natural and harmless, it can harbour spores of the Clostridium botulinum bacteria. Adult digestive systems can easily deal with these spores, but infants under 12 months lack the intestinal defences to stop the bacteria from producing toxins. This could result in infant botulism, a severe condition that affects the nervous system. But the silver lining, after their first birthday, babies' digestive systems are mature enough to handle honey. Number two, whole nuts and nut pieces. Whole nuts, chunks of nuts, and even large dollops of nut butter pose a serious choking risk for babies. Their airways are small, and they're still mastering the art of chewing and swallowing properly. Number three, cow's milk as a main drink. While modest quantities of cow's milk can be incorporated into cooking or blended into meals from about 6 months, it shouldn't substitute breast milk or formula as a primary beverage until after 12 months. Cow's milk lacks the appropriate nutritional balance that infants require for proper growth and development. Number four, added salt. Infants' kidneys cannot process sodium in the same way that adult kidneys can. Incorporating salt into baby food or offering babies salty treats places needless pressure on their developing organs. And number five, added sugar. Similar to salt, added sugar isn't suitable for babies under 1 year old. It delivers empty calories, devoid of nutrition, can harm developing teeth, and may establish unhealthy taste preferences that persist into childhood.
A much-loved Coventry museum has explained the reasons it is no longer taking donations of a particular item. The Coventry Blitz Museum, located at the Cathedral Ruins, has quietly become a popular part of the city's way of remembering the war and the air raids that changed the city forever. Self-funded, run by volunteers, the museum is full of genuine 1940s artefacts donated by the people of Coventry and by families of former Coventry residents now living abroad. Some treasured items have even come from as far away as Australia. But there is one item the museum is no longer accepting donations of, due to two reasons. One, they've loads of them already, and two, they can be dangerous. And these are gas masks. The Second World War saw a genuine fear of chemical attack by the enemy. The concern was so strong that gas masks were issued as standard to all civilians to protect people from potential attacks, which in the end never did materialise. They used a specific material that was not only resistant to heat and fire, but would also filter out toxic gases in the atmosphere. This material was known for being durable and flexible, meaning it was able to be used for a myriad of different things. What wasn't realised at the time is that the material itself was toxic. Millions of gas masks were handed out to UK civilians, including specially made Mickey Mouse ones for children. Incidentally, today is Mickey Mouse Day, I'm told. But these gas masks were made using asbestos. Mike Neal, manager at the Coventry Blitz Museum, said gas masks are the most common item they get offered. Although it's lovely to see them, he said, and quite often they are in their original boxes, we just can't take them. The filters inside the gas mask were asbestos. Over the years, if it hasn't been removed, it gets too dangerous as it's breaking down and the fibres get airborne. So, the museum will open for the final time this year on this Saturday as part of the civic celebrations marking 85 years since the 14th November Blitz of 1940, before closing for the winter and opening again in February 26, but with no extra gas masks.
An expert has revealed the five plants every household should own to enhance well-being. As he says, they are much more than just looking good. Joe Bagley, author of How to Make Your Houseplants Love You and presenter of BBC Gardeners World Live, explained that houseplants are not only easy to maintain, but also possess remarkable oxygenating properties that support better sleep and sharper concentration. Indoor jasmine can bloom for several months indoors, giving off a sweet fragrance utilised for relaxation and therapeutic purposes, while the rubber tree has featured in numerous studies for its air purifying capabilities. Meanwhile, the umbrella tree stands out as the perfect houseplant for remote workers, believed to ease tension and enhance productivity. The organisation also commissioned research involving 2,000 adults, which found the typical person keeps just 4 houseplants in their home. Commenting on this matter, Joe said, "It's worrying to see millions of people are missing out on their daily hit of vitamin G, the incredible well-being benefits of houseplants." Houseplants are about so much more than aesthetics. They help reduce stress, improve air quality, and even support better sleep. Having greenery indoors is a simple way to stay connected to nature, especially during the darker months. Orchids are the UK's favourite houseplant, with 25% of plant owners saying it's their top pick, followed by aloe vera and cacti. According to one poll figures, residents believe the best rooms in the house to keep them are the living room, then the kitchen, and then the hallway. However, they aren't for everyone, as 1 in 5 people have no living houseplants in their home, compared to 4% who have over 20. Of those who have no living houseplants, nearly 3 in 10 avoid them because they simply cannot keep them alive.
Outlook News.
And a big thank you to today's newsreaders, Peter and Elaine. Now then, sunrise is now 7:25 a.m. and lighting up time's now at 4:08. It's getting earlier and earlier, and I'm pleased to say that you've come to join us. Hello, you.
Thank you very much. Of course, I'm known in the horticultural world as Black Thumbed Hugh, because I only have to look at a plant and I can kill it, which is why I let my husband do all that sort of thing. So therefore, we have lots of lovely plants in the house that he looks after. Yes, quite a few things to tell you about this week. So we've got the winter warmer coming up on the 29th of November, which is a week on Saturday, if you're getting this earlier in the week. So, of course, lots of lovely things going on. We're going to be having a raffle. Now, the raffle is will be started sort of around or a bit before the winter warmer, and we're going to carry it on until the week before Christmas. And in fact, I haven't told our good friends here at at Outlook, but we will be doing the draw live, as it were, on the programme on the Wednesday, the week before Christmas. So that will be we'll do a big draw online for who will win the raffle prizes. The first prize is going to be a lovely Christmas hamper, and second prize, we've got some fantastic Coventry Blaze tickets, and I know a lot of people really enjoy the ice hockey, and there'll be lots of other things as well. So tickets are going to be £1 a pop, and they'll be able to come in books of 5, so you can get, you know, it's a special discount, 5 raffle tickets for £5, you know, because that's the law. You can't do discounts on them anyway. Look out for the winter raffle that will be coming up. Now, last week I was I just need to mention about the bus for the winter warmer as well. So if you need the bus to come in, you need to give us a call on 024-7671-7522 and either talk to reception and let them know that you need the bus, or if you manage to get hold of Carl, let Carl know that you need the bus, and your name will go down on the list and he will arrange for you to be picked up and possibly taken home for the winter warmer. Now, yes, I say last week I was very firm about the date that the Tommy trip was going to happen down at the Criterion Theatre, and I confidently suggested that it was going to be the 4th of February. let me retract that and say that we have something else going on the 4th of February. So it's going to be on Tuesday, the 3rd of February. Tuesday, the 3rd of February. And unless somebody else tells me that that day's out, that's the day that it's going to be. So we'll do the same usual thing. We've already got a list of people who really want to come. If you'd like to come, please let reception know. We'll do fish and chips beforehand, then go down for the touch tour, and then stay for the show later on in the evening. Yeah, Pinball Wizard, absolutely. It's going to be loud and rocky, and I hope so. Looking forward to it. And it'll be the first production at the refurbished Criterion. Uh-huh. So looking forward to seeing that. Now, I've been talking recently to the BBC, you know, because that's the sort of chap I am.
Are you going to sue them?
No. Yeah, a billion. That would be nice. I could use that. But no. They have had reports, so we're talking about BBC locally, they've had reports about difficulties that visually impaired people may have had being inpatients up at the hospital, and also about getting information in an accessible format from the hospital. And they would really like to talk to some people who have recent experience of being inpatients at the hospital, whether visual impairments have been taken into account, you know, whether they've done things like introduce themselves, whether they've helped you with your food and all these sorts of things. Now, I mean, I did a straw poll just in the in reception last week about this, and two people said, I've just been in hospital, it was awful. What the BBC are looking for, people who'd be willing to talk live to them, so people are willing to talk about their experiences. So we just need two to three people at the most. If you've had recent inpatient experience at the hospital, whether it was really good or really bad, I have to say, or anywhere in between, you know, I'd be quite interested to hear from you if you think that you'd like to talk to the BBC about that as well. There is another issue that they're looking into, which is about getting medical information in an accessible format for yourself. So, for example, a discharge letter. Now, we know that appointment letters can often come out in accessible formats, or at least large print formats. But, you know, are you getting appointment letters in a format that you can read, or, you know, like audio, or however you would, or braille, however you would prefer it? And similarly for anything like discharge letters or medical information that the hospital sends home with you. So they're interested in that issue as well. So if you've got experience of that, if you've got a good justifiable opinion about that, that you're willing to talk to the BBC about, I'd like to hear from you, and that right soon, actually. So if Monday, Tuesday next week, that would be quite useful. So thank you very much for that. Another event coming up Thursday, the 11th of November. The Stoneleigh.
December.
That's the word. December. Thank you. I'm so glad I've got instant editors right here. It's fantastic. Okay, Thursday the 11th of December at Stoneleigh Village Hall, the Stoneleigh Ladies Choir are holding a concert, an afternoon concert, which is nice, at 1:30 p.m. So if you happen to be or want to be near Stoneleigh on that day, you can go to that concert. The reason I mention it is because they're doing it in aid of Coventry Vision Hub and indeed of Warwickshire Vision, so we're sharing the honours on that. The reason being, obviously, that it's a Warwickshire Choir, but also two of the members are volunteers here. Helen and Jean, who volunteer at the Creative Writing Club group, rather. So they've put in the bid. So they're supporting two charities supporting people with visual impairments. If you'd like to go, the tickets are £10, you can, well, we'll help you manage it, but if you are able to get onto the website, it's www.stoneleyladieschoir.org, stoneleyladieschoir.org, or you can telephone 07817 899097. I'll tell you that again, 07817 899097 for tickets. I imagine that I will be going to talk a little bit about the charity, perhaps. So that's coming up there. So I hope lots of people will go and support that. I imagine they'll get apparently they tend to get quite good audiences. I'm going to talk really serious subject here. Biscuits.
Oh.
We sometimes get asked, where's the biscuits? And the thing is, we don't supply biscuits here. We never really have. Sometimes we get somebody gives us a big donation of biscuits and we put them out. Otherwise, we don't really supply biscuits. If people would like to supply biscuits, we're always happy and grateful for donations of biscuits to go into the biscuit barrel so that people at various groups can have them. That's all I'm going to say about biscuits.
Oh, well.
From me, not boring ones, please. But anyway, I mean, I know what a boring biscuit.
Any preference?
Well, I can tell you what I consider to be boring biscuits is, I have to say, it's just plain digestive. So the world's most boring biscuit, I have to say. The best biscuit by a country mile is the plain chocolate hobnob. But I know not everybody shares that view, however erroneous they are. So that's biscuits. So we're always very grateful for biscuit donations. Please feel free if you fancy to make a regular biscuit donation for the Gaiety of Nations. Carl was not here on Monday because he went down to Devon on behalf of the charity, and the reason he went down to Devon was to go and have a look at our new bus, which is currently being fabricated down there or converted from a standard old Citroen van into a glorious new minibus. So he sent back some lovely pictures of where it's at. Basically, it looks like a shell, but apparently it only takes him a week to do. So from a shell to finished minibus, it'll be finished by about Tuesday next week. We're not going to get it until January because it's got to go off for testing and it's got to go to Bristol for something. So we're looking forward very much to getting that new bus in January, and we may also be getting another, not new bus, but another second-hand bus to replace our darling old, but very old, little Renault, which has it's now 17 years old and is... owes nobody anything. I mean, when we first bought it, we thought we might have it for 4 years, and we've had it for nearly 10. Wow. So it's done very well indeed.
Just about takes the
biscuit. So we're very excited about new buses coming within our orbit. Hopefully, as of the new year, we will be operating 3 minibuses. Ooh. And that just goes to show, how many more people are using Coventry Vision Hub, and how thriving the charity really is. If you'd like to help to continue the charity to be thriving, we know Christmas is the season for donations, and we're always glad for those, whether biscuit or financial, but preferably financial. So, and that is it for this week.
Right. Well, thank you. And try not to kill too many houseplants.
No, I'm afraid it's a given with me. I do stay away from them.
Right.
I'm sorry there's no sports news this week, as Sarah is away, But in its place, she recorded an interview with Nurse Faye from University Hospital about that nasty condition that can creep up on you without you knowing. We're talking about bowel cancer.
Well, I'm in the studio today talking to...
Faye.
And Faye is...
I'm a specialist screening nurse from University Hospital in Coventry.
And what particular screening do you work on?
Bowel cancer screening.
Okay, folks, please do not switch off or fast forward. This article could save your life. So, Faye, what would you like to tell us about today?
I'd like to tell you about the bowel cancer screening programme, mm-hmm. because it can find early signs of bowel cancer, which is more treatable, and it looks for polyps.
Oh, what is a polyp?
Okay. A polyp is a fleshy growth inside the bowel. So polyps are very common.
Mm-hmm.
Most polyps are harmless, but it's important they are removed because some of them may eventually develop into cancer.
Right, so I suppose a comparison is a bit like warts on the skin. Even though they say they're harmless probably at an early stage, sometimes they will remove them.
That's right, Sarah.
Right. So I think I received a test. So what is the criteria for receiving a test kit?
So it's for 50 to 74-year-olds. You must be registered with a GP, and these test kits will be sent to you at home every 2 years.
So just because you receive one doesn't mean that your GP suspects that you've got bowel cancer. It's just because of your age.
That's correct, Sarah.
And are there any particular underlying conditions that can trigger earlier test kits, or what would you do if you think you may have? Can you just phone up to get a test kit?
If you think you may have bowel cancer, you should see your GP and they can refer you to the hospital urgently. They may ask you to complete a poo kit.
So what are these poo kits?
Okay.
Because I know when mine came, it seemed to be a sort of test tube with a cotton bud,
yep,
on the end.
That's a good description. So it's a home testing kit.
Mm-hmm.
It will come with instructions and a free post envelope.
But what happens if you can't actually read the instructions?
Okay. So there is a FitAid tool with a link to a website, and you can click on the link and access in the instructions via audio,
mm-hmm.
or video.
So how do you actually get hold of one of these FitAids if they're not sent automatically to you?
If they're not sent automatically to you, mm-hmm. there is a free phone number for our bowel screening hub, and that number is 0800 707 6060.
So that's 0800
707 6060.
Right.
Free phone.
And I think a lot of people, well, I may be supposing here, but some people are put off because they just think, you know what, I don't want to know. So what are the actual advantages of, if you've got bowel cancer,
okay,
finding it early? I mean, I know you hear that all cancers are better found early.
That's right, because they're more treatable. But with the bowel cancer screening programme, we're also looking for polyps. And if we find any polyps, they can be removed during an investigation called a colonoscopy. So So that would reduce your risk of developing bowel cancer in the future.
Mm-hmm. But I don't have a family history of bowel cancer, so why should I bother?
Because all screening programs are to reduce your risk of developing cancer. They're not for people with symptoms of bowel cancer. They're preventative.
I've received one of these kits with or without the FitAid, is it?
Yes, FitAid is the tool to help visually impaired complete the kit.
Right, but what do I do with it?
What do you do with the kit?
Yeah.
So you need to catch your poo in either toilet paper or a clean empty container. Right. So something like a takeaway box.
Mm-hmm.
So
presumably after you've cleaned it.
Exactly. So you would put the container into the toilet bowl, or you can hold the container.
Mm-hmm.
You catch your poo in the container and then put the container somewhere flat, because you need to open up the kit, which is a tiny plastic tube with mm-hmm. a stick in it.
Mm-hmm.
So you open the kit by twisting the lid and pulling the stick out of the Fit bottle.
So is the stick actually attached to the lid?
By a small sticky label, so by twisting it you can break that action to pull it apart.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then you have to scrape the stick back and forth on the poo sample, but you only need a little bit to cover the end of the stick.
Now that may be quite hard for some of our listeners,
yes,
to work out, because I think there's often a feeling of, oh, well, have I got enough? Oh, I'll go back in and get a bit more, sort of.
Yes.
With anything,
yes,
when you can't
course.
See your
yeah.
quantities. So in what way does the FitAid kit help?
So the FitAid kit helps you to stand up the tube or lie it flat with the stick the other end. There's a groove in the FitAid kit, so you can use it to slide the bottle and the sample together, and then it should click. Or you can place the Fit kit upright in the FitAid kit and then put the sample in, and again it should click. But what it won't do is tell you if you've got enough
yeah.
of the sample.
What happens actually if a sample comes back and there is too much?
It would probably be recorded as a spoilt kit, in which case another one should be issued.
And will you be told if that happens that this is just a duplicate because your last one was spoilt? Or will you just suddenly find, oh, they want another one, does that mean the last one was suspect?
It should come with a letter explaining that the kit was spoiled, and then a new kit.
Right.
So it's a letter from the hub, which is the bowel screening hub in Rugby.
There's so many hubs, aren't there, folks?
There are. This is all the bowel cancer screening hub, and it's based in St Cross in Rugby.
Right.
On the free phone number we gave.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I think that's about all my questions from me. Is there any other points that you would like to say?
Well, just to say, once you've completed the kit, you can put it into the free post envelope, put it in the post box. You should get a result within 14 days.
Mm-hmm.
So if the result says no further tests are needed, it means that no blood was found in your poo. You don't need to do anything else. You'll be offered another screening kit in 2 years. So most people will get that result. However, if your result says that you need further tests, It simply means blood was found in your poo and needs to be investigated. And then you would receive an appointment with a specialist nurse that will talk to you about the results and what happens next.
Right, and you're one of these specialist nurses, are you?
Yes, I'm one of a team of specialist nurses. So we work at Coventry Hospital, St Cross in Rugby, George Eliot in Nuneaton and Warwick Hospital as well.
Gosh, that is really good, because often transport
is one of
the key problems with people who've got a visual impairment.
Yep. So you'll always be offered the nearest available appointment to your home address. But in certain situations, if there isn't an appointment within a couple of weeks, you may be offered an appointment at another hospital. But again, you can phone the free phone and they can move the appointment for you.
Right. So can you just remind us again of that free phone number?
Of course. It's 0800 707 6060.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time this morning. And come on, listeners, what's stopping you? Don't put it off. Go for it.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you, Faye.
Thanks to Sarah and Nurse Faye, we all need to be vigilant and do the tests, don't we? Now here's Dave with your postbag.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hi there, and a big welcome to your postbag again this week. We begin with a lovely message from Doreen Hilton to Julia, congratulating her on all the lovely handmade crocheted poppies she made, which were sold on behalf of the Royal British Legion and Coventry Vision Hub. Here's Doreen.
Hello everybody, this is Doreen Hilton speaking to you again. Thing I'd like to say, Julia, I must say, on your feedback from your poppies, I think you've done very, very well. The good work you've done is really, really excellent. And I'm sure last year you done a few poppies as well. And I'm sure you will carry on with that. I hope you do keep the good work up. And the other thing was, Julia, what a very, very nice comeback you had. £332. So I must say thank you very, very much, Julia. And also, I've known you for such a long time, since 1987, and you've done tremendously well from where you've got. From the day you told me you turned blind in 1986. But never ever let that bother you. Keep up your good work with your poppies and also making cards. Every one of your Christmas cards, your birthday cards you've made for me, I have completely kept, because they are so lovely. Anyway, Julia, hope you are listening to that. I'm Dory, and I hope to see you soon. Maybe at Torch, maybe at the Winter Warmer. Take care, Julia. God bless. And God bless you all, to the, all the ones in the Resource Centre, and all the good work the team do together. Bye all. Doreen Hilton, signing off.
Thank you, Doreen. Julia does a fantastic job of making her poppies, something that was recognised previously by her teacher, John. Now, here's a piece of creative writing given to me by Derek Headley. Apparently, I didn't read it all last time, so here we are. It's called The Swimmer. A group of lads have gathered in one of the corners of the school's playground when one of them notices a very tall lad carrying his school bag slung over one shoulder, striding towards them. "Look, here comes Johnny!" All heads turn towards the approaching male, And in unison, smiles begin to emerge on everyone's faces. "How many races did you win this weekend, Johnny?" asked Pete. Johnny replied, "Five or six. I got tired of keeping count." "Johnny, you're like a fish," Steve said. "Who are you calling a fish, Steve?" "No, Johnny, I just meant how fast you swim," spluttered out Steve. Danny, the pacifier of the gang, quickly stepped in. "I'm sure Steve meant to say merman. Look at you. You are 6 foot five, not an ounce of fat on you, and you fly through water faster than most people can run." "Yeah, you're right, Danny. I meant merman." "I'm just an idiot," said Steve, trying his best to replicate Danny's tone. "Merman, hey, I like the sound of that," says Johnny with pride. After another brain-numbing day in bottom groups and no sport until Wednesday, Johnny sat in his bedroom staring at his homework he was never going to start. Looking up from his books, his eyes fell upon the multiple ornaments dominated by swimming trophies and medals. Instead of bringing joy, pleasure and pride like they used to, what surfaced was fear of not winning. The burn to win for his coach, his parents, the gang, the school, and it seemed the entire world got greater with every win. Johnny rose from his desk and laid on his bed, facing the ceiling, letting his mind wander. External voices started to penetrate Johnny's mind as he scanned the room. He realized he had unconsciously turned on the TV. Picking up the remote to turn off the TV, Johnny noticed an interview was taking place on a sun-drenched beach. "So, Paul, you've been sea-swimming for 5 years now. Why do you do it?" asked the interviewer. "Well, it's so invigorating. When you're out there, it feels like it's just you and the ocean. All your fears, stresses are stripped away. So when you return to the shore, you believe you can take on the world and win," replied Paul. So, viewers, that's why the phenomena sea swimming is sweeping the nation. Well, that's all from me, and it's back to Sally in the studio. Johnny switched off the TV and whispered to himself, "Merman," thinking about the conversation he had with the lads this morning. "That's what they called me. Perhaps this sea swimming will make me enjoy the sport again. I might start looking forward to the swim before school instead of dreading it. And best of all, enjoy the win again." A month later, Johnny and his parents were laying on the beach. It was a glorious hot summer's day. It had taken a lot of nagging, sulking and persistence. It was worth it, as finally Johnny and his parents had made it to the seaside. "Well, this young stud's going for a dip," announced Johnny. With a touch of alarm, Johnny's mum, Wendy, says, "Hold on a minute, Dave, shouldn't you go with him?" "Oh, Mum, all I want to do is go for a quick swim, all by myself." "Don't, oh, Mum, me, when all I'm doing is looking out for you." In order to dampen the rising tension, Dave, Johnny's dad, decided to intervene. "Oh, okay, Wendy, let the lad enjoy himself." Dave readjusted his position, so he was staring directly into his son's eyes. "Now, Johnny, I see where your mum is coming from, so be careful out there. Don't swim past the red buoys. The sea can be dangerous. It's unpredictable, and it can change in an instant." "Thanks, Dad. I'll be careful out there. I've taken on board everything you said." Picking up on Dad's lead, Johnny casually strolled to the shoreline, hoping this would make him look more mature. In an attempt to calm his mum down and prevent her egging on his dad to follow him, so the one thing he could not do from this point on was look back. Placing one foot in the sea felt fairly cold. Nothing, however, was going to deter him from this swim. The swim he had been planning for ages. The swim that could dramatically change his life forever. And there'll be the concluding part, part 2 of The Swimmer by Derek Headley next week. Elizabeth has been to the Belgrade Theatre recently. Here she is to tell you all about this fantastic show.
Hi everyone. This week's roving report is from the Belgrade Theatre, which had a rollicking performance of Like a Bat Out of Hell, Anything for Love, starring Steve Steinman. Steve put in a stupendous performance as Meat Loaf. Accompanied by his very accomplished band and three very sensual lissom young ladies, wow, the audience were up on their feet, raring to dance. The pyrotechnics were amazing. What a fabulous evening.
Thank you, Elizabeth. All the songs in the show were written by Jim Steinman, who also wrote songs for Bonnie Tyler, such as Holding On for a Hero. Jim wrote Bat Out of Hell originally for a futuristic version of Peter Pan called Neverland, which he wrote for a workshop in 1974. He was American. The musical at the Belgrade Theatre, Bat Out of Hell, Anything for Love, featured Steve Steinman, who is no relation to Jim. He has an accent that reminded me of Bobby Ball of Cannonball. His real name is Steve Murray. He comes from Oldham and he won Stars in Your Eyes on TV in 1993. Since then, he's travelled the world performing Meatloaf songs for the past 30 years. His special guest in the show is Lorraine Crosby, who was the female lead vocalist on Meatloaf's Grammy Award winning song, I Would Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That. Hence the title, Bat Out of Hell, Anything for Love. So now you know. Well, thank you very much for your contributions to Postbag this week. I'm sure we'll hear more messages next week. Okay, I was very sorry to learn of the death of Pauline Lawrence, first of all. I do remember a lovely comment she made after one of my parts of the interview with Charles Duke for Apollo 16 went out. And she said, how fascinating to hear firsthand from someone that's been to the moon. I really appreciated that, because people seem to take things for granted these days, and that was quite wonderful. And also, I was very sorry to learn the death of listener Eva. And she was always willing to make little contributions to my reports that I did, like the walking group, for instance, and also the play we went to see at the Criterion. She was lovely. Thank you. And I was very, very sorry to hear of the sad loss of her. Okay, thank you very much, and that's all from Postbag this week. More hopefully next week. And just remember, you can phone us up on 02476 717522 and press 5 for Coventry Talking Newspaper, or any other way you feel happiest. Okay, bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
Thanks, Dave, for this week's Postbag. Please do keep your contributions coming. Elaine's back up north this week to the village of Over Whittaker.
Over Whittaker is set in the gently rolling hills of North Warwickshire, halfway from everywhere to anywhere. That is, Birmingham to the west, Tamworth to the north, and Atherston, Nuneaton and Coventry to the east and the south. Sadly, it can no longer be described as a quiet country parish, as it is now quartered by busy roads. There have been many changes in the last decade and more. The population has considerably increased, and the inhabitants are now urban workers and not farm labourers. There was a village shop and post office, both now gone. One of the few remaining collieries in the Midlands lies within the parish. However, the modern privately owned Dore Mill Colliery is tucked away into a valley. In the valley by the Bourne River, the settlement of Furnace End grew up around a watermill used for iron smelting. The wealthy and influential North Warwickshire Jennens family established this iron forge in the second half of the 17th century. Charles Jennens became well known as Handel's patron, commissioning him to design the now famous organ in Packington Church. He also wrote the libretto for The Messiah. The watermill had been left untouched, but is now an award-winning residential development. At the top of the hill, with a view for miles, is St. Leonard's Church, built in 1766 by a squire who wanted something fashionable. He replaced a medieval church with a Georgian gem, one of the few small churches built in this style of the period in Warwickshire. With the changes in farming practice, much of the meadowland around the village is now ploughed up to produce maize and potatoes. In spite of all the changes, this parish, with its gentle rolling hills, bluebell woods, natural pond and the river, attracts many ramblers using the network of public footpaths.
Thanks, Elaine. Next week, she's going south to the village of Oxhill. Now, hats off to the British bowler. Here's Margaret with the second part about how it became the nation's crowning glory. It's taken from the Daily Express and written by James Moore.
Elsewhere in popular culture, comedians Charlie Chaplin, Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy would make them a hallmark costume piece, and the bowler also became the stamp of dapper secret agent John Steed in TV's The Avengers, played by Patrick McNee. In the 1964 James Bond flick, Goldfinger henchman Oddjob wore a flat-top Cambridge-style bowler with a razor-sharp steel brim, which he wielded to deadly effect. Made by Lock & Co. themselves, one of the props later sold for £62,000. Lisa Minnelli wowed in a bowler for her saucy turn in the 1972 movie Cabaret, while the style was given a more sinister vibe by both Malcolm McDowell as the twisted Alex in the dystopian 1971 film A Clockwork Orange, and the villainous Ridley in Batman. Over the years, everyday wearers have included Prime Minister Winston Churchill and designer Coco Chanel. The bowler has even gone into battle. During World War II, eccentric officer Major Digby Tatham Water achieved fame during the Battle of Arman in 1944, by leading a bayonet charge against the Germans wearing one while carrying an umbrella. Tatham Water was obvious onto something else. The hat's toughness meant that in the later 20th century, they were refashioned as headgear for Britain's female police officers. In Scotland and Northern Ireland, bowlers became synonymous with the Protestant Orange Order, while in California, the Brown Derby restaurant chain even built a branch in the shape of a hat. However, by the 1970s, sales of the bowler had declined. Bowler's own factory closed in 1962. Paul says, fashions change and hat wearing per se changed, particularly thanks to the rock and roll era, where it became fashionable for men to style their hair. But bowlers haven't entirely died out. These days they are often worn by royals such as Prince William, ex-servicemen, doormen of posh hotels and stewards at racecourses. Felicity Barnard, Deputy CEO of Ascot Racecourse, says, "For more than 60 years, our stewards, often called bowler hats, have worn them with pride. Even today, the bowler hat remains a timeless icon at the racecourse. They can be collector's items too. In 2006, Charlie Chaplin's bowler hat and cane set sold for nearly £80,000. While earlier this year, one worn by Stan Laurel fetched £12,800 at auction. A new traditionally made bowler will set you back anything from £200 to £600. But in recent years, they've been given a boost by a new legion of hipster celeb wearers. Jude Law, who wore one to play Sherlock Holmes' sidekick Dr. Watson on film, has been seen wearing one off set too, while female stars, including Britney Spears, Taylor Swift, Fern Cotton, and Daisy Lowe, have also been seen sporting them. Paul says, "Generally, hat wearing is creeping back. We sell them here all year round." Jonathan Boston, Managing Director of Top Hat Maker Christie's, adds, "It's a hat that we very much still make and supply to quite a wide variety of wearers that still see it as an iconic piece of headwear. Internationally, it's forever etched in people's minds as the classic British style and appeals to Americans and customers in the Far East. Despite the vogue for cap-like headgear in recent years, he'd like to see the bowler make a wider comeback. I don't think there's any reason why not. I think people are, more than ever, seeing headwear as being a good accessory and actually want those items to be iconic and super traditional. We're definitely finding that it's the traditional classic styles people are looking for. That's really encouraging. For a lot of people, the bowler has a place in their hearts as much as their heads. It's a classic style that never goes out of fashion." Mark Fitzer, the current head keeper at the Holcombe Estate, says gamekeepers there still wear black bowlers today, in a nod to those pioneered by Edward Coke. "The staff are specially fitted with their own at Lock & Co. after 2 years of service." He says, "It's actually pretty waterproof and robust. There are probably more practical hats now, but I'm proud to wear it in its birthplace. It's a badge of honour, and I think traditions like that are very important."
Now here's Nigel to tell us about ants, the secret workforce beneath the forest. This is taken from Landscape magazine.
"The mellow light of an early autumn afternoon slips down the tree trunks on the edge of the woodland, washing the countryside in September warmth. A few sheep doze on the pasture near the trees, and there is a sense of serene idleness. Suddenly, a loud yaff wakens the sheep as a green woodpecker takes off from the grass. Something has caught its attention. A glance along the tree line gives a clue as to what that has attracted the woodpecker. Beneath the trees, bathed in sunlight, a great earthy mound rises from the ground, and here life is far from idle. Scurrying across the wooden floor around the mound is a great number of wood ants going about their daily business. The wood ant's mould is a remarkable structure. It can rise up to 6 feet in height with a spread of up to 10 feet, though many are smaller. The mound is often built around the decomposing trunk of an old tree. It offers the ants protection against weather and predators, and stands as a kind of organic monument to the organisation skills of the extraordinary little creatures that call it home. Wood ant nests are found on well-drained woodland soil, south-facing to make the most of the sun's warmth. The mound's surface is covered with a variety of woodland material, including pine needles, twigs, leaves, dry grass and pieces of moss and lichen. This protects the interior from rain and helps to raise the temperature inside the nest, warmth being necessary for brood development. However, there is much more to the home of the colony than the obvious overground structure, for beneath this is a subterranean ant-made world that is at least as extensive as the mound that tops it. The intricate underground realm of the wood ant contains a network of tunnels and chambers that are the domain of a well-ordered, complex colony. Within the chambers can be found the queen of the colony, a nursery for brooding future generations, and food larders. The tunnel entrances can be opened or closed with twigs to maintain the ant's desired level of temperature and humidity. And the entrances may also be closed at night and guarded by a worker ant. Different ants fulfill different interrelated roles, and a single nest can be home to 250,000 individuals. The workers are approximately 6 millimetres long, always female, and have come from a fertilised egg. The queen and brood are looked after by young workers. As these workers age, their duties extend to the maintenance of the nest, and when they are older still, they become the foragers, bringing in food supplies from the surrounding woodland. All these duties are packed into a relatively short lifespan. Most workers only live for approximately 1 month, although some may overwinter, and the queen can survive for as many months more. Queens, like the workers, come from fertilised eggs, but have been fed a highly nutritious diet. They are larger than the workers, with a big, glossy abdomen. It's thought that the queen can live for 10 to 15 years. Sometimes queens may succeed one another, meaning that the nest and colony can survive for decades. Male ants come from unfertilised egg, a characteristic of a genetic system termed haploidoid. They are approximately 10 metres long, and the one aim in their short life is to mate with the queen, after which they die. A single nest may not produce queens and males each year. So well organised are ants' social structures that some recent studies have discovered that individuals may behave in such a way as to suggest they are nursing injured ants for the greater good of the entire colony. Occasionally there is more than one queen in a nest, and this can trigger a process known as budding, with several nests may be found in close proximity. The satellites are offshoots of the larger ones, where a fragment of the original colony has split off to establish a new nest. This may involve parasiting nests of other ant species. The foraging of the ants results in a clear system of pathways across the forest floor, and they may choose any type of woodland, coniferous, deciduous, or mixed, in which case they make their home. Ants are marvellous creatures. Globally, there are thousands of species, and probably even more thousands that are, as so far, unknown to us. More than 50 species of ants are in the UK, including 4 species of wood ant. The southern or red wood ant is our largest, although it does not occur in Scotland and is rare in Ireland. It is found in other parts of the UK, particularly in the south. The Scottish wood ant is found where its name suggests, with one colony also being recorded in Northern Ireland. The European red wood ant has become extinct on mainland Britain and is now only found in the Channel Isles. The appealingly named hairy wood ant, which often appears darker compared to the other species, is found in Scotland, as well as northern parts of England and Wales, giving rise to its other moniker of northern wood ant. Wood ants have compound eyes and hear by feeling ground vibrations. They have sensors on their feet, which help them be aware of their surroundings, and also feel with hairs on their bodies. Their sensitive antennae provide information about their environment, and they have a keen ability to smell these. They communicate with one another via sound and touch, as well as using pheromones to transmit chemical messages. This system is better developed in ants than any other insects.
Nigel will be back with the second part next week. But now Bernadette Allen discovers the towns, the houses and the cobbled streets that inspired the great novelist Charles Dickens. And she also shares with us how to step into his world during the festive season. This is taken from the This England magazine and is read by Elaine.
Charles Dickens was born near Portsmouth in 1812, but after a brief stint living in London, moved as a young boy with his family to Chatham in Kent. It was here and in nearby Rochester that his lifelong love of writing was formed, where he later wrote the local characters excited his curiosity. Dickens' early association with London was not a happy one. Having run up substantial debts, his father moved the family back to the city, to the run-down Camden Town, when Dickens was 10. 2 years later, Dickens Sr. was sent to a debtor's prison, and young Charles, just 12, was sent to work in Warren's blacking warehouse to help pay off the family debts, provoking his lifelong activism against child labour and poverty. It may have been a difficult beginning, but London seeped into his bones, inspired by his fondness for walking the city at all hours. "I suppose myself to know this large city as well as anybody in it," he said. And on those walks, magnificent stories were first imagined into being and then shared with the public. Dickens would eventually leave the blacking factory to take up a job as a clerk in a law firm, a profession he shared with young Scrooge in A Christmas Carol, and later became a journalist. He started to publish stories and literary sketches in Monthly Magazine from 1833. 1836 was a big year for Dickens. His first novel, The Pickwick Papers, was serialised from April, which was also the month he married Catherine Hogarth. The Pickwick Papers was an instant hit and published in book form the following year. But the marriage ended in 1858 when he fell in love with a young actress, Ellen Ternan. But before the breakup, Charles and Catherine had 10 children and lived at different London addresses. Only one of these houses remains, 48 Doughty Street in Bloomsbury, where the family lived from 1837 to 1839. It's here Dickens finished the Pickwick Papers and wrote Nicholas Nickleby and Oliver Twist, sealing his international success. 48 Doughty Street is now the Charles Dickens Museum, and Christmas is one of the best times of the year to visit. Every room in the house is decked out for the festive season, as it would have been in Dickens's time. By the time he died in June 1870, at the age of only 58, Charles Dickens had written 15 novels, 5 novellas, and hundreds of short stories, articles and essays. Although he died a wealthy man, he never stopped advocating for the poor and disadvantaged through his journalism, public speaking, and most importantly, his stories. He constantly challenged the Victorian notion that poverty was caused by moral failings, most notably, memorably, movingly, in his most famous story of all, A Christmas Carol. It was 6 weeks before Christmas in 1843, and Charles Dickens desperately needed a hit. Martin Chuzzlewit had been an unexpected flop after the success of Oliver Twist, and his publishers were threatening to cut his income. With a wife, 4 children, and a 5th on the way, this wasn't the Christmas message Dickens wanted to hear. So he started to walk, clocking up miles every night on the streets and alleyways of the City of London. A story started to form in his head. A story of giving and joy. A story of forgiveness and humility. A story that shows we are never too late to change and make amends, never too late to find happiness. This story, celebrating the true spirit of Christmas, would be published on the 19th of December 1843 and immediately sell out. It would never subsequently be out of print, and it would go on to become one of the most adapted books ever for stage and screen. This story, A Christmas Carol, is one of the most famous Christmas books ever written. It can be said that the Charles Dickens story starts and ends in Rochester. While Dickens' lifelong love of walking led to his writing many books composed on these nightly walks through London, it also led him to his final home, a place he dreamed of since he was a child. Walking with his father in Rochester, they often passed a house called Gad's Hill Place, an 18th century mansion built for a former mayor of Rochester. He was later to write, "I used to look at it as a wonderful mansion when I was a very odd little boy, with the first faint shadows of all my books in my head." His father said that if Charles worked very hard in his life, maybe one day he might buy it. And in 1856 he did, and spent the last 14 years of his life there. It is now a school, though open to the public on selected dates every year. A Swiss chalet erected in the garden, a present from his actor friend Charles Fechter, became his writing studio. It was here, working on his final novel, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, with the characters and scenes drawn from the Rochester area, that he became ill and died a day later. The chalet can now be seen in the grounds of Eastgate House in Rochester, and a fund is underway to restore it. The author's connection with the city comes into its own at Christmas, when the annual Rochester Dickensian Festival is celebrated on the first weekend in December, with Dickensian characters, costume parade, street performances, workshops and carol concerts. Well done, Charles Dickens, and happy Christmas.
Thanks to Elaine. And now Dave goes on a peace walk with Coventry's Lady Godiva around places of worship. The Peace Walk was part of the Peace Festival in Coventry that takes place in November to coincide with the Coventry Blitz.
Hello there, I'm speaking to you from Priory Gardens and I'm about to go on a peace walk with Prue Peretta, Coventry's Lady Godiva. I'm speaking to Citra. So what does these peace walks mean to you?
I really enjoy coming on the peace walks because it really shows how diverse Coventry is and how welcome we are to people from various cultures and religions, and I think it's a great way to connect with new people.
Okay, right, I'm speaking to Mac now. Now, I met you at the Coventry Vision Hub, and then you were talking about the showdown,
yes.
And you're also serving the cafe.
Yes, okay. That's it. Good morning, everyone. How are you?
Yes, it's, how do you like these peace walks? What do they mean to you?
It's the first time at my peace walk, so yeah. It's nice to show that everyone's together in Coventry, a different religions, that we all can all walk as one. It's nice. I like it. It's a good message.
Okay, we are walking through Priory Gardens at the moment, and I'm walking with Coventry's Lady Godiva, Prue Peretta. So what do you think about the peace walk?
Oh, it's wonderful. We've been doing this now for about 30 years,
yes.
And I think it's so important because Coventry has the message of peace and reconciliation, and we're walking in the footsteps of so many saints, really, throughout the centuries, because we're in what would have been Godiva's church,
yeah.
And then we're going over to Holy Trinity Church, which is one of the ancient churches of our city, one of the three spires now,
yeah.
And it was in Godiva's gift that when she died she left that half of the city for the prior, and St. Michael's, which is the other spire, she left for the wealthy, the lords and the earls.
Yeah.
So it's taking those footsteps again, and then we're going off to a mosque,
yes,
and then wonderful. We go off to a Hindu temple,
yeah.
And we finish at the Gurdwara. So, and it's the sky is blue, the sun is shining on us. It's such a beautiful day.
That's
we know that lots of people have come,
they
and
have,
we're so
yes.
happy that they're with us today. Everybody's following in those footsteps.
I'm speaking to you from Holy Trinity Church. I'm speaking to the Reverend Richard Hibbert. There's a stained glass window of kind of broken parts of the window.
Let me share. It's extraordinary. These are remnants of glass from the war when we lost most of our windows here, our Victorian windows. And this here was the remains were gathered together and put in one column in one of the windows. And towards the bottom, you can see a little tiny face of a lady, a little beautiful face of a lady. And by tradition, that's meant to represent Lady Godiva, who, of course, was so important in the life of Coventry. And probably, although not directly, this church probably knew of a church on this site even 1,000 years ago. There's been worship on this site of Holy Trinity for over 1,000 years now.
Wow. So when do you think that stained glass window was painted?
Well, I suspect I'd like to think it's probably just Victorian, but I'm told it's got medieval glass in it. So we're going back to the medieval period, which is quite extraordinary.
Excellent. Yeah, thank you. Can you talk about the Doom painting, please? About, there was one that to do with the alewives.
Yeah. Okay, the Doom painting, and Doom is a medieval word for judgment, just to help us understand, is an extraordinary 1430 painting. Yeah. And in it depicts Christ, but there's lots of little details. Yeah. There's clearly St. Yeah. Peter, but there's also the humour that goes in of there's these alewives, and these are the women are depicted, and they're depicted as not being good, because they're seen as people who've watered down the ale you would have had in the ale house. Outrageous of them.
Just been walking through Lady Herbert's garden, and I'm speaking to Helen. So how did you hear about the Peace Walk, and what does it mean to you?
The Peace Walk, it appeared on my Facebook, and when I saw that we were going to visit temples and the Gurdwara, I've lived in Coventry for all my life, really, and I've never been to any of those places, and I thought it would be really nice to join the Peace Walk with everybody else and visit all the different faiths.
And we're about to enter a Muslim mosque. Well, I'm inside the... I am talking to Shabir Ahmed. Now, you used to be a Lord Mayor, didn't you, of Coventry?
That's right, that's correct.
Excellent. So how do you feel about this Peace Walk, people walking around the various places of worship?
Well, Coventry City is well known and rich in terms of peace activities and trying to get communities together. It has been going on for a very long time, and the communities do appreciate who are coming to Coventry to reside and to work, and they find Coventry as peaceful as it can be anywhere in the world.
That's excellent. Right, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm walking along. What's your name, by the way?
Joseph.
And what brings you on the Peace Walk?
So I've always been somewhat interested in other religions and learning about them.
Yeah.
So this serves as a good opportunity to get access.
Okay, so where are we going into now?
So right now we're going into the Sri Krishna Temple.
Yeah, Hindus.
Yeah.
Okay. Hello. So what's your name?
My name is Krina.
And where are you from?
I'm a Romanian.
Romanian, yes. And what brings you along to the Peace Walk?
I'm the Romanian sister for the Godiva lady.
Oh, that's right. So yeah, Godiva sisters.
Yeah, she has around 30 of us, so I represent the Romanian sister.
Yeah.
We are trying to attend where possible her community events, and we would like to explain people our heritage by showing off our traditional costume.
Excellent. Well, we're inside the Sri Krishna Temple, and Prue Peretta is just ringing the bell. Right in the front of the temple there are various gods. I think one's Krishna, and they're dressed in pink. I'm speaking. Can you describe briefly your beautiful temple, by the way, and the table in front of the deities dressed in pink?
Okay. The temple has been here since 1992 when we consecrated the grounds and built this from scratch. And what you see there are the five more key deities, which our priest mentioned to you. Lord Ganesha, number one.
Yeah, I know that.
Lord Krishna in the middle.
Yes.
Mata deity Durga, the mother goddess.
Yeah.
Lord Shiva, the destroyer, and then ultimately Hanumanji, who is of the Ramayana faith, or fame rather. So these are our main deities of almost every Hindu temple in the country. You'll find five. And what you see in front of us today is a setting up of a special spiritual wedding, which is a reflective wedding between Lord Vishnu. Lord Krishna is a reincarnation of Vishnu. He had 10 incarnations, if you remember incarnations I mentioned earlier on. And one of the things was that he did something to Mata Tulsi and therefore had to make a promise that he will marry her every year.
Oh, I see. Right.
Every year.
Really?
And today is that one of those occasions for us.
Right. And what do you think of the peace walk around various places of worship?
I think it's an important one. It's been going for a long time. But what it does signify for me is the fact that it's spreading the notion and the good message of peace. Because if the fates were all okay together, we would not have any disputes around the world.
Okay, I'm on the peace walk. We've just come out of the Sri Krishna Temple. We're going towards the Sikh Gurdwara. I'm speaking to a gentleman now. What's your name?
I'm Martin Beckett from the Baha'i community in Borsal Common.
Okay, what's the Baha'i community?
It's a faith that started in the Middle East in the middle or the second half of the 19th century. Its main tenets are the unity of man, the unity of God and the unity of religion, in that there's only one God, therefore effectively the only one religion, and of course only one mankind.
Hi, I'm speaking to you after a nice meal in the Sikh Gurdwara. I'm speaking to Henny, whom was the guide at Bagot's Castle. So what do you think of the peace walk today?
I am Henny, and I am a Godiva sister. This event was really, really amazing to see all the different worship places. I enjoyed each and every one. They're so beautiful. And to finalize the day or finish the day, we had an amazing meal.
Thank you, and that's all from the Coventry Peace Walk around the places of worship in Coventry with Prue Peretta. Bye for now.
And that peace walk brings us to the end of this week's Outlook. So from me and the rest of the team, it's bye for now.